I'm delighted now to welcome to the program Robert J. Lifton. He's a distinguished psychiatrist, researcher, author, and activist. His memoir, Witness to an Extreme Century, was published by Free Press this month. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this is a fascinating memoir of a life lived with passion and thoughtfulness and love and academic rigor, all interwoven. Over the course of your life as a scholar, you have done four main bodies of research around which the memoir is structured: Chinese thought control, Hiroshima and its survivors, Vietnam War veterans, and Nazi doctors. And one of the themes that runs through all of this work is a deep objection to what you call totalism. What is totalism, and what are some of its manifestations in the areas that you've studied?
Well, totalism is really a psychological equivalent of totalitarianism. So it means absolutism. It really means a claim to omnipotent truth and complete virtue and a right to contest and even destroy anyone who doesn't share that belief or that particular version of virtue. It's enormously dangerous when it takes hold anywhere, especially on the part of an entire nation, but it can also have smaller pockets in certain groups like cults. And, you know, it was the center of my very first study of Chinese thought reform, or so-called brainwashing, but really manifestations of it were present in all of the studies that I did, so it becomes a leitmotif, as I say, for my work and my red flag in terms of what I oppose.
Having become a doctor and a psychiatrist in the 1950s, you were steeped in the traditions of Freud, but you kind of broke away from diagnostic categories like neurosis and began to see people's psychology as a response to the historical forces around them. Let's talk for a moment about Chinese thought control, which was perpetrated both on Chinese citizens and on Western prisoners. What was the nature of these practices, and what was the original impulse behind them?
Well, the impulse was part of the revolutionary elan of the Chinese communists, in which they saw themselves as possessors of complete virtue and wanted to impose those views on their own people mainly, but also on Westerners whom they encountered. And the process as used with Westerners in prisons was brutal, with lots of physical pressure and torture. And the one used on Chinese, which was the main expression of thought reform, was coercive, but without physical brutality. It had more exhortation, the promise of a revolutionary dawn. But really, in both versions of it, it consisted of confession extraction, and then criticism and self-criticism, and particularly strong group pressures in the effort to convert people into becoming communist-minded. But I quickly came to see that it wasn't this kind of process, and this kind of totalistic approach wasn't limited to the Chinese communists. Certainly, it was an outgrowth of their revolution, and it's really remarkable to see the contrast between what the Chinese communists were and did at that time, where they were then seen as incorruptible and really living out these ideals, whereas now there couldn't be more cynicism in China about ideology, and corruption is rampant. So there's a radical change in that scene over the course of my research lifetime.
You were approached at one point by a United States intelligence agency that was calling you to ask for your help in a secret program that would develop thought control programs for the U.S. You said no, but it brings up a big question about to what extent the U.S. has practiced and continues to practice thought control of its own prisoners.
Well, unfortunately, the CIA and some other American intelligence agencies became enamored of, quotes, brainwashing, which is a term, you know, that it became very popular and couldn't be dispensed with, but it doesn't mean anything very precisely. And with the CIA enamored of this seemingly mysterious communist method, they wanted much of it for themselves. It's hard to know how much it has been used, but certainly in what we have seen and various expressions of torture in recent days, there's now hard evidence that the findings about Chinese communist thought reform have been applied by American intelligence groups. Originally, there was a project to protect American prisoners or American soldiers who might be taken prisoners from these approaches by informing them what they were and putting them through some of that kind of process so that they could learn what it was. But unfortunately, that changed into an embrace of the actual methods. And just a couple of years ago, there was a kind of smoking gun in the form of a document that was a briefing document for Americans in Guantanamo, and it listed the findings about Chinese thought reform on the part of another researcher and said that this was what one does in one's own interrogation. So, yes, there has been an embrace of the very kind of thing that people like me in Discovering try to warn against instead of that CIA impulse to have much of their own. But I and others have tried to counter this tendency, and I could even testify in a case against the CIA that was mounted by some victims of research that the CIA sponsored. Much of it has been exposed by other scholars in relation to the concept of the Manchurian candidate.
The study of thought control brings up the question of its opposite. What is freedom of thought? What is true freedom of thought, if there is such a thing?
Oh, there is indeed. And at the end of my study of Chinese thought reform, I had a section on what I called open personal change. And I tried to quote and develop ideas from anthropology and psychology and psychiatry and literature that suggested possibilities of openness as an alternative. In my work, I really felt a kind of responsibility not only to study examples of closing of the mind or thought reform, but of alternative approaches to openness. And I think that's very important. We need to use these studies of transgression into elaborating alternatives.
One thing that I found really fascinating about your study of thought control in China was that it was rooted in Confucianism in a certain way, and there was a sense of when you oppose something, it still retains its basic nature. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Yes. It's a kind of paradox that one of the targets of thought reform was Confucianism and the traditional culture of China, which the Chinese wanted to wash away. And yet some of the methods that the Chinese communists used had a Confucian flavor. And one former Chinese communist leader, whom I was able to interview in Hong Kong way back in the 50s, told me that when they met with Russians who were advising them on various matters, some of the Russian advisors accuse them of being too Confucian in their manner. And in Confucianism, you do find a focus on persuasion and trying to change people in order to improve them. And there's a phrase in Confucianism or a principle called the rectification of names, in which people are supposed to be changed in order to meet and live up to certain names or positions they're given. So it is the irony of making use of methods that come from a tradition that one is attacking.
Do you consider any institutions in our society to be, in one way or another, forms of thought control?
Well, I try to bring all of my studies back home, so to speak, especially in the last part of my memoir. And we've had pockets of totalism in our society, and they can be dangerous. I think particularly during the Bush administration, there was an attempt to control the media and an attempt to suppress thought that was antagonistic to that of the administration. it isn't that. It was limited to the Bush administration, and it hasn't disappeared now, but it was particularly prominent then. There weren't systematic thought reform programs put forward by the government, but there were efforts at mind control, and there were totalistic tendencies. I mean, you can find totalistic tendencies even in our war on terror, as it was described, in which you, as they themselves, the perpetrators of the war on terror, would say, wish to eliminate not only terrorists, but eliminate evil. And, of course, that can take on a polarization of the world and can take on its own totalistic dangers.
We're talking to Robert J. Lifton. Now, you studied the survivors of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima, and although you were from the country that dropped the bomb, almost all the people you interviewed were open to talking with you, and the process, as you describe it, was both informational and therapeutic to the people you were speaking with. Describe some of what you call the special knowledge that survivors of a disaster like this have.
Survivors of Hiroshima had a special knowledge of death, and not only death, but large-scale death. And that could function on many levels. They felt they had experienced something that no one else had, and of course, that was true. They also came to feel that they could have valuable knowledge for the world and a message for the world so that they could simultaneously do a service to the world by telling people, and they have systematically gone around the world in various groups telling their story, telling what they had experienced with the first use of an atomic bomb in a way that's a warning to the world of the dangers that we're in. And at the same time, that could be therapeutic for them because survivors need a sense of meaning in terms of what they've been through and often a sense of mission in carrying out that meaning.
There were some people, and this is true with any disaster, who shut down and others who open up and go for that quest for meaning. What determines which way they'll go and what helps them to open up?
I think there's no easy answer to that question, why some can open up and some close down. But a kind of sense of possibility, when, first of all, in a survivor's whole recovery from that death encounter, he or she requires aspects of love and understanding and some sort of hope for the future. And if survivors can see that evolving meaning as hopeful for their own future, then they can embrace it, and their embracing it can often have value for us, as in the case of Hiroshima survivors. I encountered many examples of great resilience among Hiroshima survivors, which would include an embrace of this survivor meaning and often a survivor mission. And that was also true among Auschwitz survivors, whom I interviewed in connection with my study of Nazi doctors. And in fact, all through my work, it's been a mixture of enormous destructiveness and involvement in some cases in evil, as in Nazi doctors, along with examples of impressive capacity to cope with the most extreme kind of trauma, which I've also encountered.
Describe the phenomenon of psychic numbing.
By psychic numbing, I mean a diminished capacity or inclination to feel. And I first came across what I came to call psychic numbing among Hiroshima survivors. And for them, it was a useful defense mechanism. They would describe to me how they could understand something of what was going on around them. They saw people dying, a sea of death around them, and they saw various injuries and their own struggle, could experience their own struggle and be aware of it to try to stay alive. But in a matter of minutes and sometimes even seconds, they found that they felt nothing. They didn't have any emotion. They were like a kind of neutral screen, and that kind of numbing or diminished feeling was necessary to a degree for their surviving, With survivors, the most extreme numbing can be harmful because you're unable to take the steps towards survival, but a certain amount of numbing is inevitable and necessary to one's efforts to survive. So what I described it as, the capacity to undergo a kind of symbolic death in order to protect themselves from actually being killed or actually having their mind destroyed. Now, that defense mechanism for survivors, I began to think about in relation to people at the other end of the weapon, or people who made decisions to use the bomb, or who worked in making the bomb, and the numbing that they underwent, and the numbing that we all undergo in relationship to thinking about nuclear weapons or other extreme threats. So in that sense, psychic numbing could be a danger and a source of withdrawal from some of our major problems. And I began to think about this whole phenomenon of psychic numbing as part of the human repertoire, something we're all capable of doing and something we do all the time, even in everyday forms. And I held to this terminology because it isn't like standard psychoanalytic concepts of repression or derealization or other such terms. It's a concept that only deals with feeling and non-feeling, and it does seem very, very important in our time.
Well, it does indeed, and part of that is observing politicians who are so cavalier about war and torture and destruction of all kinds. I mean, even here in New Mexico, doing things that would poison our water sources and pollute the land and things like that. Is there a way that you've found to draw people out or jolt them out of their psychic numbness?
Yes, psychic numbing is all around us, and it increases and sometimes decreases in intensity. Well, one way, for instance, I was very active in the physicians anti-nuclear movement, both nationally and Physicians for Social Responsibility and internationally, International Physicians for Prevention of Nuclear War. And we found that, on the one hand, we went around the country and then around the world in describing what a 1 or 10 megaton bomb might do on the particular city in which we were. But we found that in addition to that kind of fear, it was very important to disseminate some idea of hope, some hope at the other side of the fear. And it's hope, I think, in being able to confront these issues that can alleviate or diminish numbing. We felt that in the doctors' movement, in at least modest ways, and then they were recognized when the Nobel Prize was awarded to the international movement, but we felt that we were diminishing psychic numbing about something that it was very, very hard to confront and let into one's mind. But we always did it by some kind of combination with a feeling of hope, a sense of hope. And I think that does best in diminishing psychic numbing rather than simply thrusting people into further fear and description of destructiveness.
We're talking to Robert J. Lifton. Now, in your study of Vietnam, you wrote about the atrocity-producing situation, atrocities like the My Lai massacre, and one of the things that was very important, and this comes up as well in your research on the Holocaust, is that people who actually resisted participating in one atrocity or another actually expressed more guilt about what they did or failed to do than people who participated fully in the atrocities. What is going on there psychologically?
Yeah, that was kind of sad and paradoxical. An atrocity-producing situation, as I described it, is one in which it's so structured militarily and psychologically that ordinary people, no better than you or me, could be capable of committing atrocities. And those were the extreme military policies in Vietnam in a counterinsurgency war where you couldn't tell the combatants from civilians, and yet people were dying and soldiers were experiencing angry grief about those deaths. Now, I interviewed one person who was at My Lai and who had refused to fire, and he was one of those people who seemed to feel more guilt than those who actually participated in it, though I think in the case of My Lai, the participants also came to experience guilt over time. But sometimes the victim of atrocity or of some kind of brutal behavior can experience more pain and more guilt than those who perpetrate it. And the reason for that is something like this. If you're a victim and you experience this kind of extreme trauma, you can feel guilty over not having helped others to survive or about not having done more to combat that evil that you knew was there, even though it was impossible for you to do much more. Whereas those who perpetrate the destructive behavior separate themselves, they dissociate themselves from the experience, distance themselves, or numb themselves to the experience, and therefore don't take it in. And not taking it in, they may be less prone to guilt about it. That isn't always the case, but it's all too often, and it was sad to witness.
There's a passage in the book about military people against nuclear weapons and even against many wars. You call them military doves. Describe their mentality and their form of idealism.
Well, yes, I was surprised and pleased to learn about such a phenomenon. And for instance, the man who didn't fire at me lie, one of his main motivations, one of the main sources of the courage of his restraint was that he had been committed to the military, loved the military, had found himself in the military and planned to make it his life, and then was enormously upset at how Vietnam and My Lai especially violated his military idealism. And there were the so-called anti-nuclear admirals and generals who, I spoke to one, for instance, who told me he had to become anti-nuclear because he had been trained in Southern military tradition, and he believed in military idealism also, and that kind of military tradition required that one defend one's country and fight to defend one's country alone, and second, that one always limit the number of deaths in terms of one's command. And he could do neither, he said, in relation to nuclear weapons. So there can be a form of military idealism that leads to military doves and military people opposing war-making and opposing nuclear weapons. And we've seen it again and again in this country.
One of the things that you talked about a little bit in the book was that when you were working with Vietnam veterans who were traumatized by the war on many levels, one of the things that they were doing in these discussion groups that you had with them and other psychiatrists was redefining and changing their concepts of masculinity. What did you mean by that?
Well, in those rap groups with veterans, which were very moving experiences, all sorts of things came out. The veterans first talked about the war and then and about what they went through in the war. And then over time, they began to insist that each other and themselves look at themselves individually and not just the war. And one of the things they looked at was why they were drawn to the war in the first place, because many of them had enlisted. And they said that they were drawn to the war in many cases because of a macho style. You couldn't be a man unless you were a soldier, perhaps not until you had actually been in combat and even killed someone. And they remembered having sat on their father's knees, their fathers telling them stories of World War II, and this was literally the case among many of them, in which they would talk about their grand exploits and their heroic behavior and triumphant experience in World War II. And the message was conveyed that in order for the son to realize his masculine moment, he had to go to war and had to engage in similar heroic experiences. So that war making and a certain kind of John Wayne macho masculinity was very central in the lives of many, and they examined that critically, looked at it critically, and emerged, often with the help of their girlfriends and wives, and their immersion in feminism. So these men then looked critically at what they had required of themselves as men and changed in their sense of being men. And that was a very moving experience to watch and to take part in.
Your work with Vietnam veterans was, as you write about it, the place where you shed your professional armor. Talk about the relationship and the balances that you found in your life between your work as a rigorous scientist and also as an involved activist and human being.
I talk in my memoir about a constant effort to balance scholarship and activism. This happened in various ways. There are times when I emphasize one more than the other, but always with an evolving sense that both were very important to me, and I think both are very important in general, because activism can give depth and meaning to scholarship, and scholarship can give knowledge and direction to activism. But in the rap groups in particular, that was a way of functioning in what was close to a professional situation with a group, though we didn't call it group therapy, but it had very strong therapeutic currents on the one hand, and yet it was an anti-war expression on the other. These were anti-war veterans who were participating in it. And there I found that it was natural for me, and not just me, but the other professionals, so-called, who were psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, people with some psychological background who weren't veterans but participated in the rap groups, it became important for us as we developed the process for this whole experience to be very egalitarian. It was on a first-name basis, and we ourselves were at issue as well as the veterans. They could ask us or challenge us, and they frequently did. And this taught me a lot about how we often stand as professionals on our ostensible dignity or hierarchical position as a professional and tend perhaps to look down on our patients or clients as not having that erudite standing. And it was in a way liberating to be egalitarian and open and vulnerable in these interactions and conversations and intense exchanges that we had in rap groups. And that affected me, and I think it's continued to affect me in my way of being a psychiatrist and a professional in general.
We're talking to Robert J. Lifton about his memoir, Witness to an Extreme Century. Now, when you took on the project of talking to Nazi doctors, you were basically signing up to study not only perpetrators of genocide, but of a genocide in which you could easily have been a victim if your family had done things a little differently, not emigrated to the United States when they did. What was it like for you, both as a doctor and as a Jew, to sit down with these men, these Nazi doctors?
It was a powerful and painful experience, ultimately very satisfying, but lots of difficulty along the way. I felt all kinds of emotions, including rage and outrage, and I was always aware that I, as a Jew, could have been their victim had historical circumstances just been a little bit different. But I was also helped enormously by many German non-Jewish anti-Nazi friends, some of whom worked with me as advisors and interpreters, and many of whom became my close friends. And I was also helped by the knowledge that I would have my say. I would write my book about all this and could see that into the future. And of course, my family was with me, and that meant a great deal in my strength to carry through this this process. But I had all sorts of emotions and had to be supported by these factors, this element of love and friendship, as well as awareness of doing an important professional study that I knew would have significance for a lot of people. That helped sustain me.
some of the Nazi doctors, as you write about, saved lives, did some good things, even as they were participating in the mass killing of an entire people. And some were aware to some extent or a large extent of the horror of what they were doing. Why did more of them not resist?
There were many reasons. These doctors, most of the doctors I interviewed were not extreme ideologues. There are exceptions, but most of them were not. Yet they had embraced the Nazis, joined the Nazi Party, because of this promise of revitalization, making Germany strong, making themselves strong again, at a time where they had been at a very low ebb and humiliated in the post-World War I situation historically. They could be, for instance, if a Nazi doctor arrived at Auschwitz, he was appalled by what he saw there, and then he was taken in hand by a couple of more experienced doctors, like Wirtz, the chief doctor there, or Mengele, and guided through selections where he chose people to live or to go to the gas chamber. They could kind of tell him and help rationalize the process as saying that, look, we didn't bring people here. We're doing the best we can. We may even be able to save a few lives. And in any case, we can't do anything about it, so we might as well just adapt. So that was the process of what I came to call adaptation to killing, adaptation to evil. It's a socialization to killing or socialization to evil. The group moves in that direction. It becomes the norm. And by socialization, it sounds superficial, but it's a profound process in which one comes to internalize the norm of the group that one is part of and needs in order to function. Even so, some of them came to recognize that this was wrong and bad, but they would never take a stand against it for a simple reason. You could have gotten out of it. You couldn't say, this is evil, I condemn you. Then you'd then be in deep trouble. What you could have said was, I am unable to do this, as though it were some personal failing. But if you did do that during the last year of the war when things were most active, you would be sent to the Eastern Front, where a high percentage of Germans were being killed, including doctors, and none of them wanted to do that. So there are all these reasons for their staying at Auschwitz and doing the work of killing.
One of the things that you felt, I guess, kind of ambivalent about was giving these Nazi doctors the opportunity to do a kind of a life review, to look back on their lives and make a coherent narrative. But that narrative really did not seem to include a whole lot of remorse.
No. I never encountered a direct expression of remorse or self-condemnation on the part of Nazi doctors. That was interesting and troubling in itself. I had been warned by a close friend and advisor, a very distinguished German figure named Alexander Mitscherlich, who had been the first to expose Nazi doctors from the Nuremberg trial. He had told me, he became a psychoanalyst, and he told me that the evil was too profound for Nazis in general of his generation to confront, and therefore they could never really repent or recognize the full nature of their guilt, and instead they used various defenses such as considering themselves victims. Most of the Nazi doctors I saw tried to present themselves to me as people who got stuck in a very difficult situation and tried to behave as well as they could. I didn't accept that version of themselves, but that's what they tried to convey to me. They tended to be a little bit withdrawn and perhaps mildly depressed, but they never underwent a true self-examination or anything like repentance for those reasons.
Self-examination and repentance is something that you encourage in doctors who have participated in torture in places like Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and other other prisons. I mean, we have our own version of that going on. Is there self-examination and repentance on the part of U.S. doctors at this point in history?
Well, I wrote a piece for the New England Journal of Medicine in which I talked about, and others now have done more extensive work on this, the involvement of American doctors or collusion of American doctors in torture. They weren't Nazi doctors. They didn't do what Nazi doctors did, and I would never equate them. But the very extremity of transgression of Nazi doctors can shed light on American doctors who also have their adaptation to or socialization to destructive behavior when that's going on in their units. And I said then, and I would say, and I say it in my memoir, that you know, we still are a democratic country and we can speak out. I can speak out as I am, and many others do, and doctors who have been involved in these pressures would do a great service to themselves and to the rest of us if they would describe openly what they had been through and the pressures toward involving themselves in torture. I haven't heard that happen, but I think it's quite possible that it can happen over time. It does take time. And I think it's very important for this country in general to confront our own transgressions, and especially our involvement in torture, doctors specifically, but also more generally. It hasn't been the problem of this administration either to favor that confrontation. I think that's a big mistake. I think it's helpful to us as a people to confront what we've been part of.
Genocide is perhaps the ultimate act of dehumanization. We also have personal and political acts of dehumanization of every kind all around us all the time, every day. Immigrants, Muslims, poor people, whatever. Are these kinds of dehumanization all essentially of the same nature and different only in degree, or is genocide its own category psychologically?
Well, one can say both. In a way, Raphael Lemkin, who originated the term genocide, wanted a special category to describe or represent the attempted destruction of a whole people, a whole group, a whole nation, or a whole ethnic group. And in that sense, it's a very special category, and it has certain psychological motivations in which this whole group is seen as threatening to the dominant group, and the dominant group can see itself as revitalizing itself, recovering, as in the case of Nazis who thought that the Nordic race had been diseased by the Jews and in order to recover had to in some way eliminate the Jews. So genocide does take on a special category, but there are psychological themes in genocide, including dehumanization, that occur very widely in other situations. And dehumanization is in, it's what it says it is. It's considering other human beings less than human beings as one acts on them in various cruel ways. And you can find that, in lesser fashion in everyday function of politicians or certain groups, certainly in war making and in violence. There it's very widespread.
We're talking to Robert J. Lifton. Did you find in your work any individual or cultural traits that act as a preventive to large-scale institutional violence?
Well, I came upon a number of individual people who had resisted violence, and they had different sources in their resistance, and I have found that people who have had backgrounds that include openness and absence of victimization of others, or categorizing others in negative fashion, stereotyping others, may have greater resistance to violence, but there are many other sources, including various expressions of idealism, whether it's of the military or of a religious kind, or simply in the case of those who, for instance, saved Jews, non-Jews who saved Jews, simply a sense of what was the right thing to do, a moral sense and a group conscience. All these things could contribute to opposing violence. And, here in general, one can say that if one has alternative expressions of realization that don't depend upon victimizing others, then one is also, I think, better able to avoid and oppose violence. One thing I would say is that students of violence have always emphasized that humiliation, a sense of humiliation, individually or collectively, can be a great source of violence. So where we hold back from humiliating others and from ourselves feeling humiliated, we can move away from violence.
In relation to nuclear weapons, you write about the idea of exterminating ourselves as a species with our own technology. And as I was reading that, I kept thinking about climate change and pollution and our ability to destroy basically the majority of the world's species and destroy our land and water and thereby commit an unimaginable, vast, inadvertent genocide. How do you think about this?
Yes, well, I agree. Certainly, global warming and environmental destruction are examples of our potential destruction of our own species with our own technology, by our own hand. It's less dramatic in some ways, although it's becoming so extreme that there are fairly dramatic expressions of it. But it's more slowly, it progresses more slowly, incrementally, as opposed to, say, nuclear threat, which can be evoked by a particular atomic bomb or those that have been already used on two Japanese cities, so that there enters into it an enormous amount of denial, or what I call psychic numbing and dissociation, that is all too easily embraced because it is so gradual. It's highly dangerous, and I think that there's something related, highly related, in destruction of our environment and global warming as a source of grave human danger and nuclear weapons. And perhaps one found their coming together more recently in the Japanese disaster at Fukushima with nuclear energy, and here the nuclear energy has to be seen, in my view, as the same stuff as nuclear weapons. So yes, environmental threat is overwhelming, needs to be constantly contested and provided with alternatives.
And as you say, and I think this is, for me, one of the big takeaways from the book, is the role of the imagination. You have to imagine destruction vividly in order to avoid it.
Yes, that's right. And that's difficult. And to get people to imagine destruction, it requires what I said before, some sense of hope in doing that. One imagines a nuclear end or an environmental end in order to prevent it, in order to take steps that might prevent it. Just as individually, one might have to imagine death in order to live more fully. And that's easier said than done, and yet it's required of us all the time.
You have written about what you call the protean self, and it seems like a kind of counterpoint to an absolutist or totalistic psychology. What do you mean by that term, the protean self?
Protean comes from, of course, Proteus, the Greek sea god who could take many different forms and transform himself from one thing to another, from one creature to another, all too readily. So I mean by protean, many-sided and changeable and transformative sense of self, some of which we all have, at least potentially, and this is an open form of self. And ideally with protean self, one need not get stuck in dead ends. One can move out into alternative ideas. And so it can be many-sided, it can be changeable, it can be open and imaginative, at least ideally. And this is hopeful because it's an alternative to totalism or a fundamentalist self, which closes down with a single absolute truth. And I see our historical situation as creating or contributing to proteanism, as does any situation of rapid historical change. And also our mass media have opened us up to possibilities of proteanism, although they don't automatically do this every time. So that this is an alternative to fixity and to being stuck in a claim to absolute truth. And I see it as a hopeful psychological direction that we can experience.
It's interesting that there is or can be a kind of dialectic between those two. So people respond to fundamentalist or absolutist thought with a desire for a more multidimensional self. And some people who are thrust into a kind of multidimensionalism, it becomes overwhelming for them and they turn to a kind of absolutism.
Well, that's right. That's well said. And there's a kind of tandem between them. And sometimes you can even have them operating almost in the same people, though changing. For instance, in one very totalistic extreme group I studied, Om Shinrikyo, the fanatical Japanese cult that released sarin gas into the Tokyo subways in 1995, they were very innovative and quite protean in their early manifestations of the cult, but they became the most closed-minded and dangerous and violent and apocalyptic cult that was around and probably a rival to any, so that they can people and groups can move back and forth. But and many people coming out of cults have used my work on totalism as a way of understanding what they've been through and then embraced some of the tendencies toward proteanism as an alternative. You know, in all of these things and in my activism in general, I try to make a point that there's no golden moment, there's no sudden satori in which we've solved everything, but it's a continuous struggle, and it moves back and forth, and we have small victories and little defeats, and one continues with this as an overall process. And that's the way I see both my writing and scholarship and my activism.
Well, it's just about time to go, but I would just like to say that one of the things that made me so happy reading this memoir is that you include your wife and your children and even your animals and write about them, particularly your wife, with so much love and respect and inclusion, which I think is kind of unusual, especially in memoirs by men. And your epilogue, in which you write about losing your wife after almost 6 decades of marriage, is so beautiful, and I just want to thank you for that along with the rest of this book.
Well, thank you so much. And I just want to say that my wife was so so instrumental in all the work I did, and I doubt whether I could have had the courage to go along and do these studies, which were so idiosyncratic, if it weren't for my wife with me and supporting me. And of course, she created her own great body of work as well. But thank you for responding to that.
Robert J. Lifton, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, I've enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.